distant glow of the way standing open behind us, unleashed my will and thundered, Disperdorius! Magic lanced from my staff, disruptive and hectic, a spear of greenish light wreathed with corkscrewing helixes of green-white energy. The dispersal spell smashed into the way and tore it to shreds, closing the passage between the mortal world and the underworld as thoroughly as dynamite brings down a tunnel. And instantly the underworld was plunged into pitch darkness, broken only by the few smoldering remnants from the gate of fire, visible only dimly at the other end of the tunnel. I heard several sharp indrawn breaths before I could bring light from my staff and my mother's pentacle amulet with a murmur and a minor effort of will. Green and blue light, respectively, illuminated the area around me and spread out for a remarkable distance, reflected endlessly by the gate of ice and its thousands of moving parts. The light revealed Nicodemus's hard, narrow eyes.
Dresden, he snapped. Explain yourself.
Sure, I said. See, the way I figure it, after I get you through this gate, I've got exactly zero utility to you people. It would be a great time for you to stick a knife in my back.
That wasn't the plan, Nicodemus said.
Yeah, you're such a Boy Scout, Nick, I said, with the best of intentions. But for the sake of argument, let's say you weren't. Let's say you were a treacherous bastard who would enjoy seeing me dead. Let's say you realized that here, in the most secure portion of the underworld, the domain of a major power, there'd be no way for Mab to directly observe what you do. Let's say your plan all along was to kill me and leave me here in the underworld, maybe even try to pin the whole thing on me so that you don't have to worry about the client later. You could just let him tangle with Mab, sit back on your evil ass, and laugh yourself sick over it. Something ugly flickered far back in Nicodemus's eyes. I didn't know if I'd gotten every single little detail of his plan right, but I was sure I'd been in the ballpark. Maybe you could still pull it off, I said. But if you do, you're going to have to find another ride. If I don't make it to the end of this, there's no one left to open the way home, and we all stay down here. His jaw tightened, but other than that, his expression didn't change.
Christ, Dresden, Gray complained. What if you get killed trying to run through that thing? How are we all supposed to get out of here then?
It was a point that had bothered me too, but I'd had few options to work with. Besides, given a choice between a psychotically dangerous bone-crunching obstacle course or Nicodemus at my back with nothing to gain by keeping me alive, I knew damn well which was more likely to result in my death. And once Nicodemus took me out, there was no way he'd choose to leave my friends alive behind me as witnesses to his treachery.
Well, golly, Goodman, then I guess it looks like you'll all be well-motivated to genuinely wish me good luck and think positive thoughts, I said.
I turned to the hulking blur that was the Janosqua. Starting with you, big guy. Come on over. I need to get a better look at this thing. A subterranean growl rumbled through the air, audible even over the grinding of the gate of ice. Hey, I said, spreading my hands. Be that way if you want to. It's not like that attitude might get all of you trapped in the underworld forever or anything. I hear like two or three whole people made it out of this place. Ever. The Janosqua rippled out from beneath his veil and stalked toward me. I'm pretty sure I only imagined that his footsteps shook the ground beneath my feet as he walked, and I had a sudden desire to flee with my arms out in front of me and my legs rotating in a circular blur. But instead, I stood my ground, eyed the Janosqua, and thrust out my jaw as it got closer. Michael laid his hand on his sword and put himself between Anna Valmont and the rest of the group, his expression questioning. I gave my head a quick shake. If Michael drew Amarachius in earnest against this crew, there would be a fight to the death, and that's all there was to it. I didn't mind the thought of a fight, but I wanted better ground and better odds if I could get them. Nick, I said, without looking away from the Janosqua, run the numbers before your gorilla does something stupid. I saw Nicodemus nod his head to one side, and Deirdre suddenly slipped between me and the Janosqua, facing him, both palms lifted in a gesture of pacification.
Stop, she said in a quiet voice. The wizard is insufferable, but he's correct. We still need him.
The Janosqua could have kicked Deirdre aside like an empty beer can, but instead he slowed, glowering down at her, and then more intensely at me.
"Arrogant child," the Janosqua rumbled.
His eyes went to the gate of ice and then back toward the now closed way.
"You think you're clever."
"I think I want to get home alive," I said. "And if I thought that you people would be willing to behave with something approaching sanity for 5 minutes, stuff like this wouldn't be necessary. Shut up and play the game, and don't come crying to me if you aren't winning. Lift me up. I need to get a look at the whole field if I can."
"Because that might help."
He lifted one rubbery lip away from his tusks and said to Deirdre,
"Rather rot down here than help this one for 2 minutes."
Then he turned his broad, shaggy back and padded away. Deirdre turned toward me, her blade hair rasping and slithering against itself, and shook her head with an expression of faint disgust.
"You've won the round, boy. There's no point in doing a victory dance, too."
"Still need the big guy to give me a lift," I insisted.
"Why?"
she demanded. I jerked a thumb at the gate of ice. "They're moving in a pattern. If I can see the whole field, if I can track the pattern, I can find a way through. But I can't see over the first row of blocks, so I need to get higher." Deirdre stared at me steadily, both sets of eyes on mine, and I dropped my gaze away from hers hurriedly. The last thing I needed at the moment was to accidentally find myself in a soul gaze with a fallen angel or a psychotic murderess with centuries of dark deeds behind her.
"Very well," she said. "I will lift you."
"How?" I asked. Her hair suddenly burst into motion, striking down into the stone of the cavern floor and sending up bursts of sparks where the steely stuff bit deep into the rock. I would have jumped back from her if doing so wouldn't have put me far enough out onto the ice to get myself smashed flat. Then some more of the blades slithered down to the floor and lay flat side by side in several layers. It was like looking at a floor tile made from razor blades.
"Stand there,"
Deirdre said. Plenty of strands of her hair were still free and moving slightly.
"I will lift you."
I arched an eyebrow at her. "You're kidding, right? What happens if you drop me? It'll be like I fell into a blender."
"Well, golly, Dresden," she said, deadpan. "Then I guess it looks like you'll be well motivated to keep your balance and think positive thoughts."
"Heh," said Gray. I glowered at him for a second and then said, "Fine," and stepped onto Deirdre's hair, keeping some bend in my knees. The hair moved, and she lifted me slowly while other razor blade strands rustled and rasped around me. There was something deliberate about the motion, as if it was taking all of her concentration to prevent herself from slicing me into confetti, and I decided that a comment about split ends and using some chainsaw oil for conditioner could go unspoken. That's what I call diplomacy. She got my feet up maybe 10 feet off the ground, which was more than enough for me to be able to look over the entire 200 yards. I lifted my staff, murmured a word, and willed more light to issue forth from it. The air was filled with droplets of water and tiny chips of ice, where the blocks were smashing into one another, creating a glittering haze over everything. But I could track the motion of the blocks well enough, and in the archway ahead I could see another lever, exactly like the one at the Gate of Fire. Seemed pretty simple. Get through the grinders, get to the lever. I scanned the place for some kind of isomander, but saw nothing. Nothing that I knew of would be able to survive all the abuse the grinders were dishing out, but that didn't mean that there wasn't something I didn't know about that could handle it just fine. My imagination promptly treated me to an image of a viscous, blobby monster that could lie flat on the floor in perfect concealment and be smashed between grinders with no particular trauma, and which would melt my face off the second it touched me. Then my imagination showed me my skinless self flailing around like a victim in a horror movie, getting blood everywhere for about 2 seconds. Then I imagined two of the grinders smashing me to jelly that could be readily consumed by osmosis. My imagination needs therapy. I closed my eyes for a second and dismissed such flights of fancy. That wasn't what I needed right now. I needed to find the pattern in the movement between me and the gate to determine the path I could take to get inside. I opened my eyes again and watched. It took me several minutes to see where it began. The movement of the nearest blocks began to repeat itself after 75 seconds or so. The next row had a similar pattern, though it was happening on a separate cycle, as was the next, and the next, and the one after that. I stood there watching the patterns for a good 15 minutes, tracking them, focused, keeping track of every separate motion in my head, in much the same way you had to do with the most complex of spells, and realized that I could simplify the model for each row to a cog with one broken tooth. As long as I entered the row on the beat that the broken tooth was aligned with me, I could breeze through it. So it just became a matter of timing my run so that the openings lined up for me, theoretically. I watched for another 10 minutes until I was pretty sure I had it and could see the patterns aligning to give me my string of openings. "Harry," Michael said finally. I held up my hand to silence him, bouncing my hand slightly to help me keep track, following the pattern. The way through was going to open about now. I leapt down to the ground and started running. I was 5 strides onto the ice and through the opening in the first row of grinders before I realized that I may have miscounted, and that if I had, I would have no opening through the next to last row. There was no help for it. The opening behind me was already gone. I'd just have to adjust on the fly. I kept moving forward, dashing ahead through a pair of house-sized grinders before they could crash together with me in the middle. I whipped to the diagonal for a couple of rows, and the air got colder and colder as I went ahead. I could stand at the heart of a cavern of ice deep within a glacier, naked and wet from a shower and not shiver, but this cold was beginning to get to me. My breath became a large plume, visible in the air, and the floating chips of ice gathered on my eyelashes, making me fear that if I blinked, they might freeze together. On I went, going over a single smaller block like a hurdler, and the cold got deeper and deeper. And while the winter night had nothing to fear from slipping on simple ice, the fine powdery sleet coating the cavern floor from all the grinding impacts did not make things easy, even for me. 180 yards or so, and things went relatively well. Then I found out that I had, indeed, miscounted. I ran for the place where the opening in the row of spinning, randomly slamming grinders should have been, and realized about a step before I got there that it wasn't coming. So I pointed my staff at the more battered-looking of the blocks in front of me, focused my will, and shouted,
"Forzare!"
Unseen force smashed into the block, sending it spinning wildly away from me. The block into which it had been about to smash went spinning after it, as if the two were attracted by mutual gravity. I followed in their wake as they smashed into a couple of blocks in the next row, and ice shattered into a cloud of mist and flying chips. Something hit my stomach, and something else hit my hand. A section of block came tumbling wildly toward me, and I bounded up into a rolling dive that took me a good 6 feet off the cavern floor, shouting,
"Parkour!"
Then I was through the grinders and into the shelter of the archway. The cold there was a living thing, something that abruptly doubled me over, my body beginning to shudder and tingle. It took everything I had to lift an arm, secure a hold on the lever with my bare fingers, and haul it steadily down. There was a loud grinding sound, like ancient ice-encrusted gears beginning to whir together, and an enormous thumping sound that reminded me of explosives going off at a safe distance. The horrible cold faded almost immediately to something merely Antarctic, and I sank to one knee and peered back the way I had come. The blocks had ceased their motion, simply dropping to the ground wherever they were moving or spinning or crashing. I was through. I stood up and waved my still-lit staff left and right in a broad motion. Then I paused to take stock of myself. My shirt was bloody, and so was my right hand. I lifted my shirt to examine my abdomen and found a small wound there. It took me a minute, but I was able to get my fingers around the end of a splinter of ice approximately the size and shape of a small nail, and I withdrew it in a little squirt of steaming red blood. ugly, but it hadn't gone all the way through the muscle, and it couldn't have pierced my abdominal wall. Not dangerous. I checked my right hand. A similar shard of ice had pierced me, but it was smaller, and the heat of my blood had evidently melted it away. It wasn't bad. I'd lost a couple of layers of skin to the frozen metal of the gate's deactivation lever, and that was it. But man, I was glad I didn't have a mirror to look in right about now. By the time the rest of the crew reached me, the air was merely wintry, and I was on my feet again, and I'd used a small fire spell to sear away the blood that was on the little shard of ice, along with the shard itself. Michael approached me with his eyes wide and said, "Dear God in heaven, Harry, that was amazing. I've never seen you move so quickly." "Yeah," I said, "there aren't many perks to being the Winter Knight, but that's one of them." "Did you shout parkour?" Michael asked. "Well, sure," I said. "That was kind of parkour-like." Michael fought to keep a smile off his face. "Harry," he said, "I'm almost certain one doesn't shout parkour. I believe one is supposed to simply do parkour."
"Do I criticize your Latin battle cries?" "No, never once."
"That is true," Michael said soberly. He nodded toward my belly. "Are you all right?" "Flesh wound," I said. "I'll get some Bactine on it when we get back, or let Charity drag out her bottle of iodine." "She'd like that," Michael said, nodding.
"Ugh,"
Asher said, stepping beneath the arch, her arms folded against her stomach.
"I hate the cold."
"Wear looser clothes,"
Valmont suggested in a voice so dry that it defied anyone listening to find any snark in it.
"Nice moves, Dresden."
"Thanks," I said. "I'm auditioning for the sequel to Frogger in a week." Nicodemus, Gray, the Genosqua, and Deirdre entered the archway together a moment later, which was not even a little suspicious. Michael turned to me with a quizzical expression on his face, and had begun to form a question when the Genosqua lunged, powering toward me with ferocious speed, and simply seized me by the upper body, his thumbs pressing against my chest, his hands wrapping around my arms and pinning them at my side. Michael swore and went for his sword, but Gray suddenly had Valmont by the hair, her head tilted back. Fingers that ended in an eagle's talons pierced her throat delicately, drawing beads of blood, and he said,
"Easy there, Sir Knight. We don't want any needless bloodshed."
The Genosqua leaned down to glower at me and rumbled,
"Please, Struggle. I would love some needless bloodshed."
"Nicodemus," Asher said, her voice sharp.
"What is the meaning of this?"
Nicodemus walked up to the arch, arm in arm with Deirdre.
"Because we have come to the gate of blood, children," he said.
He drew the Bedouin dagger from his belt, and its damascene blade glittered in the light of my staff and amulet.
"The time has come for one of you to die."
Chapter 39 Michael's sword swept out of its sheath, and the silver-white fire of Amarachius filled the archway. He said nothing. He didn't need to. He took the sword in a two-handed grip and settled into a relaxed, ready position. Deirdre and Nicodemus immediately split apart, so that they forced Michael to divide his attention between them. She dropped into a fighting crouch, while Nicodemus narrowed his eyes and became very still. Gray regarded Michael impassively, while in his grasp, Anna Valmont turned completely pale and held very still. I felt the Genosqua's summer sausage fingers tighten painfully.
Now, Sir Knight, Nicodemus said, his voice almost a growl. There's no need for this to devolve into general mayhem, is there?
I will not allow you to harm them, Michael said.
Lower your sword, Nicodemus said, or I will order Gray to kill Valmont.
If you do that, Michael said calmly, Dresden and I will fight to the death. I felt my eyes get a little bit wider, and my voice might not have been as deep and steady as it usually was, but I managed to say,
Right. We'll fight you, not each other, in case that wasn't clear.
How assured is your victory? Michael asked Nicodemus. How many times has Amarachius foiled your plans over the centuries?
You've never beaten me, knight, Nicodemus said.
Almighty God as my witness and as he gives me grace, Michael said. If you harm that woman, I will strike you down.
Right,
I said.
Me too.
Nicodemus gave me an impatient glance and turned his attention back to Michael.
You should have stayed in your little house, quietly retired, he said. You didn't matter there. I didn't care about you any longer. If you begin a fight here, you will never see your family again.
Michael smiled faintly. That is where you are wrong. With God's blessing, it will take a good many years, but I will see them again.
Think where you are, Sir Knight, Nicodemus said, his mouth quirking up into a mocking smile. The underworld is a prison for souls. Do you think yours is so great as to escape it?
I am not great, Michael said quietly, but God is. Nicodemus's smile was like something you'd see on a shark.
One of the great disappointments in killing a knight is knowing that he or she does not suffer as a result. But you are in the underworld, Christian. Here, I think, your eternity will be something entirely different than you have been promised.
On the one hand, I have your word, Michael said. On the other, I have my father's. I think I know to which voice I should listen.
This is the land of death, Nicodemus said. Death must be part of the offering to let us in. You have been so eager to lay down your life, Sir Knight. Perhaps you will do so again, rather than forcing me to slay another.
Michael's eyes narrowed. I don't think so, he said. No force compels you but your own ambition, Nicodemus. You could choose to turn back, and I will not let you destroy a life to serve your purposes.
Even if, by doing so, you force me to denounce Dresden and his mistress? Nicodemus asked. You know the consequences of that, should Mab be shamed by his failure to keep her word. And you are here on his. Should you bring this mission to a halt, Dresden will have broken Mab's word. I imagine that his death will be a terrible one.
Michael was silent for a fairly awful moment.
Michael, no, I said. You're carrying enough of a burden already.
That made him look at me, his eyes troubled. We had already been standing on some fairly shifty moral ground, and it was only getting muckier as we went forward. Laying down one's life for a friend was pretty much the definition of a selfless act. But doing it so that a monster could get his hands on a supernatural weapon of tremendous power put it in an entirely different context, and not a flattering one. Especially not for a man carrying an archangel's grace around like so much priceless china.
Wait,
Hannah Asher said, stepping forward, her hands partly lifted, palms showing.
People, wait. This is not the time for us to turn on one another. We're close. Your precious cup, Nicodemus. 20 million each for the rest of us. If you let this explode right now, none of us gets anything except trapped down here. And somehow I don't think our client will be a kind and gracious host given what we've come here to do.
Nicodemus's eyes flicked to Asher and back to Michael. He stared at the knight for a long moment and then said,
Deirdre, conference.
He looked over his shoulder at Gray and the Janosqua.
If they start to struggle, kill them.
He took a step back from Michael and then turned, walking calmly toward the other end of the archway. Deirdre went with him. Asher let out her breath in an explosive hiss.
What is it with you religious types?
Name like Hannah Asher and you aren't Jewish? I asked. She sniffed.
That's different.
I snorted, tracking Nicodemus and Deirdre's movements. They went to the end of the tunnel where there was another stretch of open cavern and a final stone wall. There was the impression of an archway carved into the stone, but no actual gate there. Shadows hung heavy over it. Nicodemus and his daughter stopped about 5 feet from the stone wall and began speaking quietly. I could feel the Janosqua practically quivering with the desire to do violence, I knew that if I showed any sign of physical resistance, he'd start on me. Maybe he wouldn't kill me, not without having another way home, but he'd be happy to crack some ribs, rip off a couple of fingers, or maybe put out one of my eyes. If things got desperate enough, that might be a price I'd have to pay, but for the time being, it made more sense to be still and keep my eyes open.
Gray,
I said,
I thought you were a pro.
I am, Gray said calmly. You knew something like this was coming, wizard. His fingers flexed gently on Valmont's throat by way of demonstration. Do you really want everyone to fall apart right now? I thought about it hard for a minute.
Not yet. Look, what I did for insurance, I said. But he's talking about killing one of us.
Wait a minute. If Nicodemus had chosen this moment to turn on us, against all reason, then why the hell was he bothering to negotiate anything? It hadn't made much sense to move against me in the first place, especially since he would need me to make good his escape. It made even less sense to start it and then hesitate. I knew him well enough to know that he wasn't a waffler. If Nicodemus decided someone needed killing, he killed them, and then he went on to the next chore on his list. He was up to something. He had to be. But what? Nicodemus was a liar through and through. This was theater. It had to be. And I realized his plan in a flash of insight. He hadn't had Gray and the Janosqua grab us because he'd been about to turn on us and kill us. He'd done it to force Michael to stay near us if he wanted to intervene, instead of intervening somewhere else. Deirdre and Nicodemus stood close together, his hand on her arm. I saw the demon-form young woman look up into his eyes, her expression fragile and uncertain, and I focused my thoughts exclusively on my hearing, listening as hard as I could. "Wish there was another way," Nicodemus was saying quietly, "but you're the only one I can trust."
"I know, Father," Deirdre said. "It's all right."
"You will be safe from the enemy here."
Deirdre lifted her chin and her eyes were wet.
"I have chosen my path. I regret nothing."
Nicodemus leaned over and kissed his daughter's forehead.
"I am so proud of you."
A tear rolled down Deirdre's cheek as she smiled, and the demon form faded away until a blade-thin girl remained staring up at him.
"I love you, Father."
Nicodemus's rough voice cracked a little.
"I know," he said very gently. "And that is the problem."
And he struck with the curved Bedouin dagger. It was an angled thrust up beneath the sternum and directly into the heart. Deirdre never broke eye contact with him and never moved a muscle. The blade sank into the hilt, and the only reaction she gave was a slight exhalation. Then she moved, leaning closer to Nicodemus, and kissed his mouth. Then her legs buckled and she sank slowly down. Nicodemus went with her down to his knees and held her gently, the jeweled hilt of the dagger standing out sharply from her body.
"Mother of God,"
Michael breathed.
"He just..."
Nicodemus held her for maybe 2 minutes, not moving. Then very carefully he laid the body down on the cavern floor. He withdrew the knife with equal care. He dipped 2 fingers into the wound, felt around for a moment, and then withdrew something small and covered with blood and gleaming. A silver coin. He cleaned his daughter's blood from it and from the dagger with a handkerchief. He pocketed the coin, sheathed the knife, and rose calmly to walk back toward the rest of us. His face was as blank as the stone floor beneath his feet. Everyone stared at him in shock. Even Gray looked surprised.
"Mother of God, man," Michael breathed. "What have you done?"
Nicodemus stared at Michael with steady eyes and spoke with quiet contempt.
"Did you think you were the only one in the world willing to die for what he believes, Sir Knight? But you..."
Michael looked like he might be near tears himself.
"She just let you do it.
She was your child. Did your own precious God not ask the same of Abraham? Did he not permit Lucifer to destroy the children of Job? I, at least, have a reason for it.
He gestured curtly at Gray and the Janosqua and said, "Release them." Gray let go of Almond at once. The Janosqua turned me loose only reluctantly and gave me a little push as he did it that nearly knocked me to the ground. Michael's mouth opened and closed.
"I could have talked to her," he said.
"If he'd given you the chance," I said. "That was the whole point of the hostage drama, to make sure you were focused somewhere else."
Nicodemus stared at me coldly. He was worried that you might say something, Michael, that in the moments before she knew she was going to die, Deirdre's faith might have wavered, particularly if someone like you was there to offer her an alternative. Nicodemus inclined his head to me very slightly. Then he said,
"You have never beaten me, Sir Knight, and you never will."
"You're insane," Michael said quietly, sadly.
Nicodemus had begun to turn away, but he paused.
"Perhaps," he said, his eyes distant. "Or perhaps I'm the only one who isn't."
Anna Valmont moved to my side and said quietly,
"Look."
I looked. Deirdre's corpse stirred. No, that wasn't right. There was movement at the corpse, but the body wasn't moving. Instead, a faint silvery glow seemed to begin radiating from it. Then there was motion, and the glow coalesced into a humanoid shape, which after a moment refined itself into a translucent silvery shade in the shape of Deirdre. She sat up from the corpse, separating herself from it, and rose to her feet. She turned and paused, frowning down at the body, and then lifted her own hand and stared at it. Behind her, the same silvery glow that had surrounded the body began to suffuse the solid stone image of an archway carved in the next wall. It spread to the edges of the carving, where a silvery, translucent lever appeared, in the same place the lever had been on the previous two gates. Deirdre's shade turned to look at her father. She smiled sadly. Then she turned and drifted over to the lever. She wrapped ghostly hands around it and pulled it slowly down. The light in the stone intensified, becoming brighter and brighter until there was a flash, and it was gone, taking Deirdre's shade and the stone alike with it, leaving an open archway in their place. Light poured from the archway. Golden light.
"Ladies and gentlemen," Nicodemus said, his voice calm, "we have done it."
Chapter 40. I just stood there for a moment, still stunned at what Nicodemus had done. I tried to think of what would have to happen to motivate me to do something like that to Maggie, and it just didn't click. There was nothing, nothing on earth I wouldn't do to protect my child.
"But you were willing to cut her mother's throat, weren't you?" said a bitter little voice inside me. "Are you any better?"
Yeah, I was better. What I'd done to Susan had been at least partly her choice, too. And we'd done it to save Maggie, and by extension, the tens or hundreds of thousands or millions of victims the Red Court would have claimed in the future. Nicodemus had consigned his daughter to death. For what? A room welling up with a golden glow that... Okay. I'm not what most people think of as a greedy sort of guy, but... All of us rolled forward a few steps toward that golden light, even Michael.
"That's it," Anna Valmont said quietly. Asher swallowed and let out a nervous little laugh. "What do you think is in there?"
"Fortune and glory, kid," I said. "Fortune and glory."
"Dresden?"
"Asher," Nicodemus said. "Check the way in for any further magical defenses.
Valmont, watch for mechanical booby traps. The Genosqua will accompany you and intercede should any guardian appear.
I thought once we were through the three gates we were in the clear, I said.
My specific information beyond here is limited to inventory, Nicodemus said. It is at this point that I had assumed the intervention of more mythic forces, if they were to be had.
He's right, Valmont said. You never assume you're in the clear until you've gotten the goods, gotten away, and gotten liquid.
Michael, I said, come with. Just in case there's anything big, bad, and smelly that tries to kill me. The Genosqua let out an almost absent-minded growl. His beady eyes gleamed reflected golden light. Of course, Michael said. He carried Amarakius at port arms across the front of his body, grasping the blade lightly in one gloved hand with the other on the handle rather than sheathing it.
Gray, Nicodemus said. Watch the rear. If you see anything coming, warn us.
Gonna be hard to collect my loot from out here, Gray said.
I'll spell you once I have the grail.
Gray nodded, albeit reluctantly.
All right.
Drisden, Nicodemus said. I took point, with Asher on my right hand and Valmont on my left. Michael and the Genosqua followed, a pair of mismatched bookends, though I noted that the Genosqua was not making threatening noises or gestures at the wielder of Amarakius. The swords have a way of inspiring that kind of wariness in true villains. I shook my head and focused on the task at hand, moving forward slowly, my magical senses extended, searching for any hint of wards, spells, or energies or entities unknown. Beside me, I could feel Asher doing the same thing, though my sense of her was that she was tuned in on a slightly different bandwidth than me, magically speaking. She was hunting for more subtle traps, illusions, psychic landmines. She wouldn't be able to detect as many things as I would, but she would probably be better at spotting what she was looking for. Valmont had removed an old-style incandescent flashlight from her bag, one that was unlikely to fail in our presence unless some serious magical energy started flying. She shone it carefully, slowly on the ground and sweeping the walls ahead of us, watching for the shadows cast by tripwires or pressure plates, or whatever other fiendish things she would probably know all about finding. We crossed to the arch, one slow step at a time, and then into the tunnel. I strained my senses to their utmost. Nothing. And then we were in Hades' vault. Imagine Smaug's treasure hoard. Now, imagine Smaug with crippling levels of obsessive-compulsive disorder and fanatic good taste. It's a pale description, and in no way a substitute for seeing it in person, but it's the best I can do. Except to say that looking upon Hades' treasure vault made me feel like a dirty, grubby rat who had gnawed his way into the pantry, and my heart lurched into thunder. And I'm reasonably certain the pupils of my eyes vanished to be replaced by dollar signs. The light came primarily from the outstretched hands of 2 20-foot-tall golden statues in the center of the room. I found myself walking to one side, enough to see the details of each statue. Both consisted of the shapes of 3 women, standing back to back in a triangle, their arms thrust outward and up, palms lifted to the ceiling. One of the women was an ancient crone. The next was a woman in the full bloom of her strength and maturity. The third was that of a young woman, recently matured out of childhood. The flames of one statue burned golden green. The other statue's flames were an icy green-blue. And just looking at that, my heart started beating faster all over again. Because I'd met every single one of them. I recognized their faces. Is that Hecate? Asher murmured, staring up at the statues in awe. The triple goddess of the crossroads, right? I swallowed.
Yes, it might be.
And it might also be Granny Summer and Winter, Mab, Titania, Sarissa, and Molly Carpenter. But I didn't say anything about that.
I pulled my eyes down from the statues and forced myself to look around the rest of the vault. The room was about the size of a football field. The walls were a parquet of platinum and gold triangles, stretching up out of sight overhead. The floor was a smooth surface of white marble, shot through with veins of pure, gleaming silver. Corinthian columns supported rooftops straight from ancient Athens in scores of small, separate display areas around the vault. Some of them were raised as much as 7 or 8 feet off the floor and had to be reached by stairs of more silver-shot marble. Others were sunken in descending rows in a curling bow that looked almost like a Greek amphitheater if it had been built with box seating. I looked at the nearest shrine, or display case, or whatever they were. The spaces between the columns had been filled with walls made from bricks of solid gold. Those were just the backdrop. The backdrop. The nearest case was filled with paintings by Italian Renaissance masters, all working in the theme of divinity, showing images of saints and the Virgin and the Christ. Veneziano, Donatello, Botticelli, Raphael, Castagno, Michelangelo, freaking Da Vinci. Maybe 50 paintings in all, each displayed as meticulously as they might have been in the Louvre, in protected cases with lights shining just so upon them, from oddly shaped lanterns that might have been made from bronze and that put out no smoke whatsoever. Surrounding the paintings, framing them, was a variety of topiary shapes, except instead of being made from living plants, I saw after several glances that they'd been made from emeralds. I couldn't tell how whatever craftsman had shaped them had done it. Hell, I could barely tell if they weren't plants at all. A fountain poured water silently into a shining pool in the display's center. But then I saw that it wasn't water, but diamonds, tiny and shining, pouring out in streams that somehow gave the impression of liquid. That fountain could have filled every backpack we'd brought with us, plus all the improvised containers we could manufacture from our clothes. Never mind the emeralds. Never mind the tons of gold. Never mind the hundreds of millions of dollars in priceless art, paintings that had probably been written off as lost forever. That was only one of the displays. And I realized, as I swept my eyes slowly around me, it was one of the more modest ones. Okay, Asher breathed, her eyes wide. I don't know if I'm about to pass out or have an orgasm. Yeah, I croaked. Me too.
Valmont shook off the awe of the place first. She strode over to the diamond fountain, unzipped her backpack, and held it beneath the spigot in a matter-of-fact gesture, filling it as if it were a bucket.
Seriously? Asher asked her. You aren't even going to shop? Highest value for the weight, Valmont replied tightly. And they're small enough to move easily. There's no point in taking something you can't sell when you get it back home.
But there's so much, Asher breathed.
Asher, I said. After a couple of seconds, I said louder. Hannah?
Yeah?
Go tell Nicodemus that it looks clear. Let's get our stuff and get gone.
Right, she said. Right. Go on.
She turned and hurried from the room. I turned to Michael and the Janosqua and said, I'm going to do a quick circuit of the room with Valmont and check for anything else, just in case. Don't wander anywhere until I give you the high sign. Michael nodded slowly. There's never been a backpack made that was big enough for the Janosqua. But he had several military-style duffel bags looped to a long piece of cargo strapping like you see used on diesel trailers on the highway. Come on, Anna, I said. Let's check for more booby traps. I started walking. Valmont shouldered her pack and came after me. I lifted my staff as we went, pouring out more light until Valmont had to squint against it, and we walked out of sight of the others. Our shadows faded to mere slips beneath the extreme illumination.
What's with the light show? She asked me.
Trust me, I said quietly, and dropped my voice to a bare whisper, leaning down close to her ear. When it starts, stay close to me. I'll protect you. Her eyes widened, and she gave me a quick nod without saying anything back. I nodded my approval, then leaned my staff against another Corinthian column, putting enough effort of will into it to make the light continue issuing forth for a while. Then I put a finger against my lips and beckoned Valmont to follow me. I cut immediately through the displays to get to the amphitheater and descended into it, heading for the stage, at the feet of the two enormous statues. Valmont looked back at my brightly blazing staff in sudden understanding. Look, everybody, Dresden and Valmont are right there, see? Nowhere near the heart of the collection. The amphitheater stage, in stark contrast to every other display in the vault, had no overwhelming riches, fantastic jewels, or precious metals. It was stark and bare, with a single block of silver-veined marble rising about 4 feet off the stage floor in its center. And upon the marble sat 5 simple objects. An ancient wooden placard, its paint so faded that the symbols could not be recognized. A circlet woven from thorny branches, a clay cup, a folded cloth, a knife with a wooden handle and a leaf-shaped blade. Why take one priceless holy relic when you can take 5 of them? And I knew exactly what relic Nicodemus truly wanted. I turned to Anna and mouthed, "Check it." She nodded and hunkered down to examine the block, moving cautiously around it. Meanwhile, I extended my senses toward them, feeling carefully for any enchantments that might be protecting them. That was a mistake. There weren't any traps on the objects, but the collective aura of power around them seared my awareness as sharply as if I jammed a penny in an electrical outlet. I let out a hiss and leaned back while my thoughts blazed with the energy focused upon those artifacts, a combined aura that made the thrumming power of a roused Amorakius seem like a low-wattage light bulb by comparison. "My God," I breathed before I could remember to remain silent. "These are weapons." I looked slowly around me. "This isn't a vault. It's an armory." Anna Valmont did not respond. In fact, she didn't move at all. I stepped around the block and found her peering at its rear side, her expression focused in concentration. She was entirely frozen. I then realized that the quality of the light had changed, and I looked up at the flames in the outstretched hands of the 2 Hecate statues. The flames had ceased flickering. They hadn't gone out. They'd simply frozen in place. The hairs on the back of my neck didn't go up so much as they let out tiny, hirsute whimpers and started trembling as violently as the rest of me.
"You are, of course, correct," said a basso rumble of a voice from behind me. "This is an armory." Slowly I turned. A man in an entirely black suit stood on the amphitheater stage behind me. He was 7 feet tall if he was an inch, with the proportions of a professional athlete and the noble features of a warrior king. His hair was dark and swept back from his face in a mane that fell to the base of his neck. His beard was equally black, though marked at the chin with a single streak of silver. His eyes... I jerked my gaze away from those caverns of utter midnight before I could be drawn into them. My stomach twisted, and I suddenly had to fight not to throw up, or fall down, or start weeping.
"Whoa,"
I stammered.
"Whoa, are, you...
"In point of fact," he said, "it is my armory, mortal."
"I can explain," I blurted. But before I could try, Hades, the lord of the underworld, Greek god of death, seized the front of my duster, and a cloud of black fire engulfed me.
Chapter 41. The black fire faded and left me standing half crouched down with my arms up around my head. It's possible that I was making a panic noise, which I strangled abruptly when I realized that the fire had neither burned nor consumed nor otherwise harmed me in any way at all. My heart beat very loudly in my ears, and I made myself control my breathing and stand up straight.
The terror didn't fade so much as drop to manageable levels. After all, if I wasn't dead, it was because Hades didn't want me dead. He did, however, apparently want to speak to me in a different room because we were no longer in the vault. I stood in a chamber that might have belonged to a Spartan king. The furnishings were few and simple, but they were exquisitely crafted of nothing but the finest materials. A wooden panel, stained with fine smoke and time, framed a fireplace and was carved with images of the gods and goddesses of Greece scattered about the slopes of Mount Olympus. Two large chairs of deep polished red wood and rich black leather sat before the fire, with a low wooden table between them, polished to the same gleaming deep red finish. On the table was a ceramic bottle. A simple empty wine glass sat next to it. I looked around the chamber. A bookcase stood against each wall, volumes neatly aligned, and the spines showed a dizzying variety of languages. There were no doors. I wasn't alone. Hades sat in one of the chairs in front of the fire, holding a second wine glass in one negligent hand. His dark eyes gleamed as he stared at the flames. The light was better in here than it had been out in the vault. I could see several dozen tiny objects moving in a steady circular orbit around his head, maybe 8 or 10 inches out from his skull. Each looked like a small dark mass of shadow, trailing little tendrils of black and deep purple smoke or mist and... Oh, hell's bells. It was mordite. A substance so deadly that if it simply touched anything alive, it would all but disintegrate it on the spot, devouring its life energy like a tiny black hole. Hades was wearing a crown made of it. On the floor next to Hades was a mass of fur and muscle. Lying flat on its belly, the beast's shoulders still came up over the arms of the chair, and its canine paws would have left prints the size of dinner plates. One of its heads was panting, the way any dog might do during a dream. The other two heads were snoring slightly. The dog's coat was sleek and black, except for a single blaze of silver-white fur that I could see on one side of its broad chest. "Sir Harry," Hades rumbled, "Knight of Winter. Be welcome in my hall." That made me blink. With that greeting, Hades had just offered me his hospitality. There are very few hard and fast rules in the supernatural world, but the roles of guest and host come very close to being holy concepts. It wasn't unheard of for a guest to betray his host, or vice versa, but horrible fates tended to follow those who did, and anything that managed to survive violating that custom would have its name blackened irreversibly. Hades had just offered me his protection, and with it the obligations of a good guest. Obligations like not stealing anything from his host, for example. I had to tread very carefully here. Bad things would happen to me if I dared to violate my guest right. But I couldn't help but think that bad things would happen to me even faster if I insulted a freaking Greek god by refusing his invitation. I remember very little of my father, but one thing I do remember is him telling me always to be polite. It costs you nothing but breath, and can buy you as much as your life. What, don't look at me like that. I'm only a wise ass to monsters. And people who really need it. And when it suits me to be so. Oh, yeah. I was gonna have to watch my step very, very carefully here. "Thank you, Lord Hades," I said after a pause. My voice quavered only a little. He nodded without looking away from the fire and moved his free hand in a languid gesture toward the other chair. "Please join me." I moved gingerly and sat down slowly in the chair. Hades gave me a brief smile. He poured wine from the ceramic bottle into the other glass, and I took it with a nod of thanks. I took a sip. I'm not really a wine guy, but this tasted like expensive stuff, dark and rich. I began, then thought better of it and shut my mouth. Hades' eyes shifted to me and his head tilted slightly. He nodded.
I feel that I should ask you about the passage of time, I said. It is possible that time-sensitive events are occurring without your knowledge as we speak.
Very little in the lives of you or your companions has occurred without my knowledge for the past several days, Hades replied.
I got that sinking feeling that reminded me of all the times I got called in front of the principal's desk in junior high.
You know?
He gave me a very mildly long-suffering look.
Right, I said quietly. It's your realm, of course you know.
Just so, he said. That was fairly well done at the Gate of Ice, by the way. Relatively few who attempt it take the time to watch first.
I said, thank you.
He smiled briefly. Do not concern yourself with time. It currently passes very, very slowly for your companions at the vault as compared to here.
Oh, I said. Okay, that's good.
He nodded. He took a sip of wine, directed his gaze back upon the fire, and trailed the fingers of one hand down over the nearest head of the dog, sleeping beside his chair.
I am not what the current age of man would call a people person, he said, frowning. I have never been terribly social. If I had the skill, I would say words to you that would put you at ease and assure you that you are in no immediate peril of my wrath.
Your actions have already done so, I said.
The wispiest shade of a smile line touched the corners of his eyes.
Ah, you have a certain amount of perception, then.
I used to think so, I said. Then I started getting older and realized how clueless I am.
The beginning of wisdom, or so Socrates would have it, Hades said. He says so every time we have brunch.
Wow, I said. Socrates is, down here?
Hades arched an eyebrow. He lifted his free hand, palm up.
Right, I said. Sorry, do you mind if I ask
his fate in the underworld? Hades said.
I nodded. Hades' mouth ticked up at one corner.
People question him.
The dog took note that it was no longer being petted, and the nearest head lifted up to nudge itself beneath Hades' hand again. The lord of the underworld absentmindedly went back to petting it, like any man might with his dog. The second head opened one eye and looked at me from beneath a shaggy canine brow. Then it yawned and went back to sleep. I sipped some more wine, feeling a little off balance, and asked,
"Why did you, intervene in the intrusion just now?"
Hades considered the question for a while before he said,
"Perhaps I did so to thwart you and to punish you. Do not villains do such things?"
"Except you aren't a villain," I said. Dark, dark eyes turned to me. The fire popped and crackled.
"Granted, I'm basing that on classical tales," I said, "which could be so much folklore, or which could have left out a lot of details or wandered off the truth in that much time. But you aren't the Greek version of the devil."
"You'd hardly think so from the television," Hades said mildly.
"TV rarely does the original stories justice," I said. "But the stories bear out that you might not be such an awful person. I mean, your brothers got up to all kinds of shenanigans, like utterly dysfunctional shenanigans. Turning into a bull and seducing a virgin? How jaded do you have to be for that to sound like fun?"
"Careful," Hades said very, very gently. "I do not deny anything you say, but they are, after all, family."
Yeah, right, I said. "Well, my point is that they each had a sphere of responsibility of their own, and yet they seem to spend a lot of time maybe neglecting that responsibility. Which is not my place to judge, sure, but such a judgment might not be without supporting evidence.
Hades flicked a few fingers in acknowledgement of my statement. But the thing is, there's no stories about you doing that. The others could sometimes show capricious temper.